It was just after noon on a bright October day. I was coming down 3rd Street. The only objects in motion anywhere in sight in that thickly built and populous quarter were a man in a buggy behind me and a streetcar wending slowly up the cross street. Otherwise, all was solitude and a Sabbath stillness. As I turned the corner around a frame house, there was a great rattle and jar, and it occurred to me that here was an item. No doubt a fight in that house. Before I could turn and seek the door, there came a terrific shock. The ground seemed to roll under me in waves, interrupted by a violent jogging up and down, and there was a heavy grinding noise as of brick houses rubbing together. I fell against the frame house and hurt my elbow. I knew what it was now. A third and still severer shock came, and as I reeled about on the pavement trying to keep my footing, I saw a sight. The entire front of a tall four-story brick building on 3rd Street sprung outward like a door and fell sprawling across the street, raising a great dust-like volume of smoke. And here came the buggy. Overboard went the man, and in less time than I can tell it, the vehicle was distributed in small fragments along 300 yards of street. The streetcar had stopped, the horses were rearing and plunging, the passengers were pouring out at both ends, and one fat man had crashed halfway through a glass window on one side of the car, got wedged fast, and was squirming and screaming like an impaled madman. Every door of every house, as far as the eye could reach, was vomiting a stream of human beings. And almost before one could execute a wink and begin another, there was a massive multitude of people stretching an endless procession down every street my position commanded. Never was a solemn solitude turned into teeming life quicker. Mark Twain. Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. Hey, thanks, Sam Clemens. You're welcome on the show anytime, and glad to hear reports of your death in 1910 were greatly exaggerated. Twain's description of an earthquake in San Francisco are from an event that occurred in October of 1865. Just 3 years and a couple of weeks later, the Bay Area was rocked by a much more massive quake on the Hayward Fault in the East Bay. Scientists from the United States Geological Survey have been working to raise public awareness about the threat posed by the Hayward Fault, which passes beneath some of the most densely populated parts of California. Earlier this year, we did a program about the so-called haywired scenario that the USGS conducted to do a scientific simulation of what would happen if a large earthquake hit the area with the epicenter in Oakland today. This time, we want to look back at the actual earthquake of 1868 and what we can glean from the historical accounts. Later on, we'll be talking to Ken Hudnut from the USGS Pasadena office about the recent catastrophic earthquake and tsunami in Indonesia, which has cost over 1,500 lives, and what warnings that event may have given us for the west coast of California. But first, our guest is the expert on the 1868 earthquake in the Bay Area, Dr. Thomas Broeker. He joins us via Skype from the USGS office in Menlo Park. Tom Broeker, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we are talking about the 150th anniversary of the what was called then the Great San Francisco Earthquake, right?
That's right, yeah.
But of course, it wasn't in San Francisco. It was in Hayward. Before we get into the historical details of that earthquake, give us just a kind of a thumbnail sketch about the tectonic setting of the Hayward Fault and where this is and why it's there.
In the Bay Area, we have a number of large earthquake faults that are all working together to move the Pacific plate, all the region of the Pacific Ocean to the west of us, northward. And so the San Andreas Fault is one of the major faults, and it produced the 1906 earthquake. But the Hayward Fault and some of the other faults in the Bay Area form a broad zone of deformation that altogether are helping the Pacific Plate move northward.
And so is it safe to say that the Hayward Fault is kind of an offshoot, but the same type of fault as the San Andreas Fault? It's one that slips laterally rather than vertically.
Yes, that's right. Almost all these faults slip laterally instead of up and down.
And as I recall, it's a right lateral strike slip fault. So if I stood on one side of the fault and you were on the other side and there was an earthquake, you would move to my right. And as it appears to you, I would move to your right. Is that correct?
That's correct. So say across the Hayward Fault, the 1868 earthquake, things to the west of the fault move northward relative to things to the east of the fault.
Yeah. So tell us about how long is the Hayward Fault?
Well, it runs all the way from nearly San Jose up to Richmond or so, the San Pablo Bay. So what is that, roughly 50 miles or so?
And so it's not as large as the San Andreas Fault, but it's been characterized as one of the most dangerous faults in the United States. And could you explain to us why that's true?
Well, it's dangerous because of its location. And its location is right in the middle of the Bay Area. So unlike the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake, which happened in the Santa Cruz Mountains, pretty close to Santa Cruz, that earthquake wasn't central to the Bay Area. It was sort of on the edges, whereas the Hayward Fault earthquake is going to be right in the center of the densely populated part of the Bay Area.
And so let's talk about the 1868 earthquake. As I recall looking at it and researching it, the magnitude was, between 6.5, 6.7, something like that. Is that the estimate?
I think it may have been slightly larger than that, something like about 6.8, a little bit smaller than the 89 Loma Prieta earthquake. And our estimate on the magnitude is based on the distribution of how strong the shaking was, as we found in newspaper reports of the earthquake.
And so, yeah, I was just going to ask you, how did we go about, because this is pre-seismometers, there was no seismographs to measure this earthquake. How do you go about trying to determine an estimated magnitude? Is it just from the historical accounts you read in newspapers?
It's a variety of things, and you sort of have to become a historian to find out about it. It turns out that back in that day, in 1868, we do have some photographs that show some of the damage that the earthquake produced, and so we can compare those against the newspaper accounts. But we don't have too many photographs because back in 1868, the only people who had cameras were professional photographers. So there's only about 50 or 60 photographs that show the damage after the 1868 earthquakes. Whereas in 1906, everyone had a camera. Everyone had their little Brownie camera. And so we have thousands of photographs of the damage from 1906. But we just have about 50 or so photos from 1868. So we use the photographs. We have newspaper accounts, as we've talked about. We have letters that people wrote, describing how they experienced the earthquake to their friends and so on. And about 40 years later, there was a scientific study of the 1868 earthquake where they went back and they interviewed some of the survivors of the 1868 earthquake 40 years later. And they got information from that. And the last thing, and it's maybe the most interesting way we figured out what happened in the 1868 earthquake, is we've gone to all the older cemeteries in the Bay Area, and we looked for evidence that tombstones have fallen over and maybe even been broken. And that gives us information on how strong the shaking was from the 1868 earthquake.
Wow, so you would actually find evidence that some of the tombstones had either fallen over or broken during the October 1868 earthquake?
Right, so we'd look for the older tombstones that were put up before the earthquake. And we'd look for evidence that they had fallen over and maybe been broken. And we'd look to see how many of those, if most of them had been pushed over by the earthquake, that would give us an idea of the magnitude of the earthquake. If just a few had fallen over, it would have been a different magnitude of 5 earthquake.
Wow, that's interesting, because I've heard of studies like of precariously balanced rocks and how they can be used to study if they fall over. That can give you an idea of the amount of shaking. But I'd never heard of studying tombstones. That's fascinating.
Yeah, it's the same idea, because tombstones can be very high and skinny, and so they're very tippy. So that was kind of a new source of information that we used to help us refine the magnitude of the earthquake.
When did you personally start getting interested in and studying this particular earthquake?
Well, I've been studying this earthquake for 10 years now, because we commemorated the 140th anniversary 10 years ago, and so it was at that point that we started looking for some of the photographs and some of the historical accounts of the earthquake, and we put that information together and came up with a new estimate for the magnitude of the earthquake.
When you were doing all of this research, were there some interesting stories you ran across from some of the survivors, some of the eyewitness accounts that you could maybe share with us?
Well, I've been looking at another earthquake that happened in Washington State in 1936, and that happened in the middle of the night. And so the newspapers it's kind of funny, they talk about the kinds of pajamas that people were wearing as they were walking around the street after the earthquake, and everyone poured out of their house and they were talking to their neighbors. And so they were talking about silk pajamas versus bathrobes and all kinds of night apparel. So you see all kinds of amusing anecdotes reported in regards to earthquakes. I don't have any specific memories of the 1868 earthquake.
When we go back through the historical accounts, one of the things that I've noticed is that I believe it was an eyewitness account that was shared during the 140th anniversary, is that this woman reported that the shaking was much harder, and I think she was in San Francisco, than the 1906 earthquake. Does that make sense?
It could make sense. The northernmost part of San Francisco actually is pointing a little bit eastward towards the Hayward Fault. And so it actually sits about halfway between the Hayward and the San Andreas Faults. So it's quite possible that the shaking somebody might experience in that part of San Francisco would have been higher for the 1868 earthquake than the 1906 earthquake. It also depends on the type of ground they were on. It was noticed in the 1868 earthquake that the parts of San Francisco that are near the Financial District and the Embarcadero building, Ferry building, that's all pretty much landfill that was made from filling in the area between the wharfs that were built out in the 1850s. And the damage that was produced in the 1868 earthquake was really concentrated in that area of landfill in that part of San Francisco. So it's quite possible that the ground there was not quite as firm as other parts of San Francisco, and the shaking there would have been felt more intensely.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. After a short break, we'll return to our look back at the 1868 earthquake on the Hayward Fault in the Bay Area with our guest seismologist, Tom Broker. October 21st marks the event's 150th anniversary. Stay with us. We'll be right back. And we're back. This is Blue Dot. I'm Dave Schlom. Let's return to our conversation with USGS seismologist Tom Broeker as we discuss the 150th anniversary of a large earthquake on the Hayward Fault in the San Francisco Bay Area. Let's talk about the shaking, because there's two different ways that you go about measuring an earthquake. One, of course, is the magnitude that we all hear, those numbers like 6.8, 8.0. That's the magnitude. But when you produce these shake maps, that's called intensity. I was wondering if you could explain to us what earthquake intensity is.
Right. As you know, that as you just said, that an earthquake has one magnitude. It's a 6.8 or whatever. But the way we experience an earthquake depends on our distance away from the earthquake fault, kind of soils that we are standing on, and so on. And so we all experience the earthquake in a different way, and we all experience different levels of shaking. And so the intensity is a measure of the shaking, and it's, say things start falling off your tables and bookshelves. Well, that's an intensity of 5. If things, you start seeing small cracks in the wall, that's an intensity 6. If you start seeing larger cracks and in the wall and in your chimneys, and bricks start falling from chimneys, that's an intensity 7. So the intensities are directly tied into things that we observe that happened around us, as well as the damage that occurred to the buildings near us. So the higher the intensity, the greater the amount of damage that we see in the buildings.
And what was the estimated intensity of the 1868 event?
I think the highest intensities were intensity of 9.
Wow. So what kind of effects would a 9 be?
Well, what happened in say, San Leandro, which is where some of the strongest shaking was all the older adobe buildings, which are unreinforced masonry type buildings. They experienced extensive damage. All the walls would fall down. Same thing for unreinforced brick buildings. Walls would partially collapse. And even some of the wood frame buildings would be slightly damaged at that level of intensity. So it was a very strong earthquake, and it showed showed why we do not, we like to retrofit our unreinforced masonry construction so that they do better during earthquakes.
Well, when you research a fault like the Hayward Fault, you study back into the past. Could you tell us a bit about what kind of history this fault has if you go back before the 1868 earthquake?
Well, before the 1868 earthquake, we don't have any historical evidence that the earthquake fault has had an earthquake. But when we dig trenches across the fault, as if we were going to lay a pipeline, and we look for evidence that the soils, different layers of soil, have been disturbed, we found evidence for 11 other earthquakes that go back almost 1900 years. And if we look at the average interval between each of those 12 earthquakes that we have evidence for, going back 1900 years, on average, we see an earthquake every 160 years. But there's an uncertainty in that average of about 60 years. So it could be plus or minus 60 years, 160 years plus or minus 60 years. If we look at the past 9 events on the earthquake, we get an average of about 150 years, plus or minus 60 years. So, but it's not like clockwork. I'm not saying that every 150 years we see an earthquake, because there is this large uncertainty. But we know, what we're trying to emphasize is that we know we're in the ballpark of when another earthquake on the Hayward Fault could happen.
Is there a way that you can measure the strain buildup from the plate motions that's occurring on a fault like Hayward?
We can measure the amount of motion, the rates of motion, using high performance GPS receivers. We can actually watch the ground move over time, and we can also measure the amount that the earthquake fault is slowly moving. The Hayward fault is an example of an earthquake fault which is very slowly moving without producing earthquakes, big earthquakes all the time. It's moving at a rate of about 1 inch every 5 years, but it's not enough to relieve the stress that's on the fault. It needs to move about 3 times faster than that. So although it's releasing some of the strain by this constant steady motion, it's only releasing about a third of the motion that it needs to, and the other two-thirds is released in big earthquakes that we see roughly every 150-160 years or so, plus or minus 60 years.
When you study the fault, there's also, as I understand, there are places where the fault is actually creeping along, where you can see on the surface the motion of the fault over the years. Could you tell us about some of those places and what that looks like?
Well, that looks like, those places look like, suppose I built a street curb and the Hayward fault runs right through that curb. Well, over time, you'll see that the curb gets shifted so that one side of the curb is offset from the other part of the curb. And that that amount of offset will increase over time. So there are places where you in the along the Hayward Fault in the East Bay where you can see street curbs that are offset 4 or 5 inches. So those curbs have been moving, constantly moving for 25 or 30 years, and offset the curb. We also see places where buildings have been built right on top of the Hayward Fault. And one example is the old City Hall in Fremont, in Fremont Central Park, was built directly on top of the Hayward Fault. And you can see the foundation, there's been a crack made right through the foundation, and the foundation has been offset about 12 inches. Through that constant, that slow, steady motion along the Hayward Fault. So that luckily that old City Hall has been closed, but it's still open as part of an earthquake exhibit, so the public can view what that offset looks like.
And of course, another famous place that you can see the motions of the Hayward Fault is the War Memorial Stadium at UC Berkeley, right?
That's correct, yes. And when they have retrofit the stadium so that it'll perform well during an earthquake, but they kept the offset that the Hayward Fault has produced in the stadium. They left that as part of the historical record of the steady motion of the Hayward Fault. So when you go to a football game at the stadium, if you know where to look, you can see, again, it's about a 10 or 12-inch offset in the walls of the stadium that has been produced by that slow, steady motion.
Well, you're a person that obviously studies earthquakes and are passionate about it. Have you ever experienced a really sizable earthquake?
Yes. I was here for the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake, and I was in the office at the USGS, and I was on the third floor. And I felt the earthquake, and I got to a place of safety, and I just watched each wave arrive, and each wave was bigger than the last wave. And I watched all the books come off my bookshelves and everything come off my desk. So I know firsthand what a large earthquake can do.
And as a scientist, do you find yourself, trying to put myself in your shoes, being, being a scientific observer of that event, are you able to do that? Or is it, just kind of so sudden and frankly terrifying that it's hard to do that? What was that like being, were you able to really be an objective observer during an earthquake?
I have to say that I was less objective observer and more sort of frightened private citizen. I'd never been in such a large earthquake. I'd never been in an earthquake anywhere near that size. And so it was, I had to say from my perspective, it was a scary experience.
It's hard to convey to anyone who's not been in a sizable earthquake, because a lot of Californians have been in what, you know, earthquakes that are small, and they think they have an idea. But unless you've been in one that's really large, you know, magnitude 6.5 and up, you have no idea of how terrifying it is.
I think it's hard to convey to people, you know, how just how sudden these things come on. You know, you have no warning usually. And all the things that you've never experienced happen. It's not just the shaking, but the building that you're in is going to be creaking and groaning and rumbling. Dust will be shaken down from the ceiling and from all the shelves that you haven't managed to dust lately. And it's just a whole, so all your senses are being hit at the same time by all these different experiences that you've never had before. So it's quite an amazing experience.
Which leads me to a natural question, and I suppose we should be careful how we answer this and ask it, but do you find yourself, when you think about this next earthquake on this fault that you've been studying intensely for years now, is it something that you would like to observe in your lifetime? Because you know it's going to happen. Is that something that you'd kind of like to be around for when it does happen, even though it's going to be, you know, a disastrous cataclysm for everyone in the Bay Area? As a scientist who's passionately studied this, is it something that you would like to experience and be around for, you know, you hope that it happens in your lifetime?
I'm not sure I hope that it happens during my lifetime. I'm cautiously optimistic about it because since the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake, the Bay Area has really done a great deal to prepare for future earthquakes. And it has done things like the toll bridges in the Bay Area and the elevated freeways have all been retrofit by Caltrans. The hospitals have been retrofitted to meet new state requirements. The hospitals not only fall down, but they become, that they remain fully operational after earthquakes. So we've seen over 30 hospitals in the Bay Area alone completely torn down and replaced with brand new buildings that are designed to perform well in earthquakes. We've seen schools retrofit. We've seen a lot of our older brick masonry buildings. Almost all of them have been retrofit. A lot of our older buildings that were built with a weak first story that have a lot of windows or garages. A number of cities in the Bay Area have mandated that those be retrofit, so they perform better in earthquakes. Because of all that work that we've been doing in the Bay Area, we will recover faster and better than we would have without that. So part of me wants to see how that goes, but I could also live without one.
So yeah.
I'm ambivalent.
That's totally understandable. But I also would think it, you know, for you and your colleagues at the USGS who've been working hard to study this fault and raise the alarm in California that this is a dangerous earthquake fault, that it must be rewarding to see all of the preparation.
It's extremely rewarding. And it's gratifying that people not only know about our earthquake hazard, but they are actually doing something about it. And it's involved a huge investment on the parts of taxpayers, governments at all levels, and the private, you know, homeowners and private businesses. So kudos to everyone for stepping up to the plate and recognizing the issue and addressing it. So one of the reasons why I wouldn't mind if the earthquake didn't happen right away is that, you know, we still have work to do. We're not done yet. We still have older buildings that need to be retrofit, and some of our water pipes and our gas pipes still, and you know, the smaller pipes need to be retrofit as well. So we still have work to do.
What is it about earthquakes that so fascinates you that's what you decided as a scientist that's what you wanted to study?
Well, I think the attraction for me is that it's when we study earthquakes and we learn more about the hazards they pose and the kinds of damage impacts they can have, it's gratifying to me to learn more about them and provide that awareness so that we can do more to help reduce the impacts of earthquakes and to make people safer. And that I just find that extremely rewarding and gratifying.
And are you planning on doing anything on October 21st to commemorate the 150th anniversary of the earthquake?
Yes, there's going to be a commemoration in the Fremont Central Park, and that's the location I mentioned where the Hero Fault goes right through the old City Hall. And so they're going to be having an earthquake festival there, and I'll be attending that and helping to educate a few more people and raise awareness.
Well, Tom Broker, thanks so much for sharing your expertise about the Hayward Fault with us today.
I appreciate the chance to talk to you and your listeners about it, and I applaud you for having this program.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our look at the 1868 earthquake on the Hayward Fault. You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Sloan. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Our next guest is Ken Hudnut. Ken's a regular guest on Blue Dot and joins us from the USGS office in Pasadena via Skype. Ken is here to discuss with us not only the Hayward earthquake of 1868, but also the recent tragic quake and tsunami in Indonesia. Ken Hudnut, welcome back to Blue Dot.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
Hey, before we talk about Hayward and the Hayward Fault, we need to talk about what happened in Indonesia Friday. Could you just kind of tell us a bit about what kind of an earthquake that was and why it's so bad?
Yeah, sure. So it struck really close to a major city called Palu that, you know, you can see in the topography, there's this linear valley, but it had not been fully appreciated just how dangerous this fault is. It's actually a faster moving fault than the San Andreas. The San Andreas slip rate is about 35 millimeters a year. This fault system that broke in this earthquake over there is about a 42 millimeter a year fault system. But I guess some people had foreseen that this kind of a disaster could occur, and they'd written papers about that. But now here we see it. These kinds of disasters can happen. And from our perspective as nerdy scientists, I hate to start getting into the technical aspects of it right off the bat this way, but we find it to be a fascinating analog to the San Andreas fault system, because even though the San Andreas is a right lateral fault, meaning that if you were to be looking across the San Andreas fault such that it ran left to right, if you saw a fence line perpendicular to the fault, it would be offset to the right. And this fault that broke over there did the opposite. It offset to the left, what we call a left lateral strike slip fault. But the other than that difference, they're awfully similar. So colleagues of mine have been using satellite imagery we've been doing what we can with crowdsourced video and ground-based photographs that people have been posting online to just learn as much as we can, as quickly as we can, from this earthquake. And it does appear to be a lot like what we might expect in a future earthquake here in California.
Well, I always thought with a lateral strike slip fault that you don't get a tsunami from that. So why did this particular fault produce a tsunami?
Well, I'll still kind of park that in the curiosity area for the time being, but I'll explain a few hypotheses I've seen rattling around. So first of all, you're right that for a strike slip fault rupture, you would not immediately expect there to be a big tsunami threat. We base that in part on the absence of large tsunamis from examples like the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, but it is a lesser known fact there was a tsunami. It just wasn't a big one in the San Francisco Bay that was written about by Professor Kanamori here at Caltech, for example. Now, there are other examples. For example, the Latoya 1958 Latoya Bay Fairweather Fault Alaska earthquake, in which case there was a gigantic tsunami associated with the earthquake. It was a strike slip earthquake primarily. But in that case, it was considered an outlier because you had this big slug of material cut loose in a bay, and the bay necked down and became narrow, so it focused the energy and made for this ginormous tsunami. It literally swept boats up and over the spit, and some people survived it. It's hard to imagine the boats getting rafted over this in this gigantic wave like that without having flipped, but somehow, miraculously, these fishermen survived it to tell the tale. It's all online if you Google Lituya, L-I-T-U-Y-A. But that was considered some kind of bizarre, anomalous thing. Now, so what we have here in the Palu, Indonesia case could be some combination of things. So one theory goes that somehow the tectonic source of the earthquake shifted the seafloor just so, and the focusing effects of that linear bay that you see there amplified the wave. And that's a possibility. It might not require an underwater slump. But then the other hypothesis is, well, yeah, the earthquake shook loose an underwater slump, and that's what generated this big local tsunami. It could be either. It could be some combination. At this point, it's really not clear.
Wow. So this is interesting to me. It just makes me wonder, should we possibly reassess the tsunami hazard for Northern California, especially due to the San Andreas Fault and the strike slip faults here?
We have not included a tsunami as part of our multi-hazard scenarios that we've done, either the shakeout 7.8 for Southern California scenario or the haywired scenario for the Bay Area, partly because we didn't feel like that was quite a credible, scientifically plausible element to add, and we didn't want people to think it was outlandish. There have been, in other cases, though, serious consideration given to adding a tsunami to a predominantly strike slip earthquake scenario. And most recently, that's the case for down in San Diego, where my colleagues, led by the Earthquake Engineering Research Institute San Diego chapter, and if you go to their website, you'll find a ton of information about this, they actually do have a concern that a strike slip earthquake like their scenario 6.9 on the Rose Canyon, which is part of the if you look to the northwest, Newport-Inglewood, we call that whole fault zone the Newport-Inglewood-Rose Canyon fault zone. But down there in the San Diego vicinity, it's just for short called the Rose Canyon. If that were to break in a 6.9 like their scenario, they think that this one particular oversteepened area in the bathymetry might cut loose and generate a large local tsunami in that case. So there's the collective wisdom of the scientific community in the San Diego Tijuana area is that, yeah, that is very realistic. And so they've been thinking about how to include that. And now this Palu example in Indonesia gives greater credence to that possibility. I think we can no longer say that Lituya Bay was just a one-off bizarre coincidental thing. You know, in this case, with the example from Palu, we now have another example that will be studied in greater detail we'll want to get bathymetry over there to see was there an underwater slump. And then, you know, for that matter, even in the Los Angeles area, we've considered it's possible that you could have a repeat of these old seafloor large slumps that in some cases were 10, 15,000 years ago. But in some of these oversteepened areas that we see offshore, it is conceivable that an onshore strike slip earthquake could shake loose one of those underwater slopes that could generate a local tsunami. So it's something we've thought about. We've never quite felt confident in making that part of the, one of these scenarios, as I said, but you know, maybe now's the time to start combining these things. It just, what we want to try to do is ensure that we're kind of in that right comfortable zone where the scientific consensus really is strongly that this could occur. We're not coming up with something that's a little too far out there.
Are there any historical accounts from perhaps the Spanish missionary days of tsunami activity on the Southern California coast?
Yeah, what springs to mind for me is other examples where 1925 Santa Barbara Channel, 1812, you know, there are some earlier historical accounts where, you know, things happen and it's not clear whether there were underwater slumps involved. And then where we do have high-resolution bathymetry off the California coast, where there is clear evidence for large-scale underwater slumps, where those have been dated, those big slumps are considerably older. I guess a short way to put that would be we don't yet have it pinned down that any of the possible early historical tsunamis were associated with any large-scale underwater slumps. So that's work in progress, I guess I'd say.
Wow. Well, nature always confounds us.
Yeah, I just thought of another one, though. 1868, Hawaii had a large tsunami associated with an underwater slump and also associated with an earthquake. So that's a little different mechanism there, though. And also the Kalapana 1975 earthquake was associated with a tsunami.
Well, bottom line, if you're ever in near a coastal area and there's an earthquake, you need to head for higher ground.
Yeah, that's right. And speaking of early historical association between big earthquakes and tsunamis, the Pacific Northwest example from 1700 is a well-known case that's been studied by Brian Atwater and his colleagues. They trace down the early historical evidence to 1700 water level records recorded way over in Japan. It had been called the ghost tsunami there, but it was well documented. And they traced that back to a source being a magnitude 9 earthquake along the Cascadia margin, Pacific Northwest, the coast of Washington and Oregon. It's another fascinating story about, you know, an early historical example.
Well, let's talk about what we've learned in the last year about the Hayward Fault. And we're celebrating, of course, the 150th anniversary of the October 21st event, 1868. Earlier this year, you were part of a team of people involved in with government and industry and scientists who all got together to do this thing called Haywired, which is a simulation of what would happen if there was a large earthquake on the Hayward Fault. What are some of the big takeaways that now that that has happened and we're going coming up to the actual date of the anniversary, what are some of the big takeaways that you could share with us from that study?
Well, what I think of as being the main takeaway is that another earthquake like the 1868 earthquake could happen any day on the Hayward Fault. And what we mean when we say that is we're not trying to scare people. We're trying to inform people and at the same time empower them. We have a little hashtag outsmart disaster where you'll see what I mean by that. We're trying to encourage resilience. And also we're trying to take stock and give credit for all the great mitigation efforts that have been done since the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake. Over $50 billion has been invested. It's actually more than that. Tom Broker's been working on tallying it up more accurately. But even though a lot's been done, a lot more clearly still needs to be done. So we're trying to encourage that new round of effort to reduce risk even more. So The Hayward Fault is special in that paleoseismologists have dug trenches through it and done radiocarbon dating of these past earthquakes on it. And so people like Jim Langkamper, Tom Fumall, Tim Dawson have assembled this tremendous record, and David Schwartz with compiling all this information together from not just the Hayward Fault, but the other Bay Area faults. So, but especially on the Hayward Fault, we have this incredible record of, you know, roughly speaking, it's kind of like layer cake stratigraphy. By that, I mean the layers of the cake, the earth going down from the surface down into the earth. And so they've cut through that with backhoes, and they've dated the past 12 earthquakes, the 1868 earthquake being the most recent in that sequence, but going back 11 earthquakes before that. And there's this regularity to it. If you take the average of the interval between all of those earthquakes, it works out to be 161 plus or minus 60 some odd years. Some of the intervals between earthquakes have been less than 100 years. Some have been more than 200 years. But on average, they're about 160. If you just look at the most recent several earthquakes, it's a little shorter interval. So it seems significant to us that we're coming up on this 150th anniversary. And we want to commemorate that as a way of helping to keep it in front of people, keep it on people's minds, because we know from our colleagues in the social sciences and people that actually are responsible for the state insurance program called California Earthquake Authority, we know that not that many people have bought insurance for their home. Not that many people we know have really taken the precautions they should to get ready for an earthquake in case it happens. So they may or may not have adequate amounts of water and food at home. They may or may not have a comfortable pair of shoes in the trunk of their car, or even the other basic necessities in case they get stranded in their car. Probably be a great idea to have a backpack in the trunk of the car that's got some food and water as well as comfortable shoes and an extra pair of socks. Much less at the workplace. So we think it's actually the rare individual that's well prepared at home, in the car, and at work. And other sensible precautions like keeping your gas tank mostly full. I know I can be guilty on occasion of that one myself. You know, but just think how much sense it makes to have your gas tank nearly full all the time, because especially if you don't have a generator at home, but you really want to charge up your cell phone. Well, if you've got an extra gas in the tank, you might want to use that to, hopefully you'll pull the car out of the garage to do this, but then run the car so you can charge your cell phone battery and make a phone call if you need to. You know, so in a pinch, your car can serve as your generator, in other words, to charge things up. And that might be the difference between having some form of communication versus not, after your cell phone battery is discharged, you know. So things like this may sound good, may make a lot of sense when I say it right now, but what we're trying to do is just get people to actually take that action instead of listening and going, yeah, that makes sense, I'll do it later, and then forgetting. So what we're hoping is that it doesn't take an actual earthquake to spur people to take these kinds of actions, but we're hoping that the Haywired scenario will remind people, and also the 150th anniversary commemoration that's coming up, that these things together will get people over that threshold, whatever that hurdle is in front of them that keeps them from taking action. We're hoping they'll go ahead and do it.
And all of that's good advice, not just for earthquakes, but any kind of natural disaster like what we've observed with the hurricanes back east. And of course, here in California, the wildfires that, you know, these things can happen and just come on so suddenly that you have to evacuate. That if you're prepared to do that, and you, like you said, you have a full tank of gas and you've got emergency supplies and you've got all the important papers that you need, that you're going to get out of that a lot better than somebody that's just not prepared at all. One of the best pieces of advice I heard about an earthquake came from your predecessor, Lucy Jones, who said she tied a pair of shoes together to the bed, under her bed, with a pair of glasses in there, so that in an earthquake, you know, she would have those shoes right there, because, you know, a lot of times it's that broken glass that can really cause damage to your feet when you're getting up in the middle of the night trying to get out of the house.
Yeah, apparently that's a really common injury, and I'll admit my own guilt. I don't have a pair of shoes and a flashlight like that tied to the bed. I should, and I've heard that same kind of thing many times. So all I can say is I know I've got stuff I should do. This conversation is making me feel bad, like, oh, I better do that when I get home. I hope other people will kind of take it the same way, as just a little jiggle or a reminder, like, hey, you know, even those crazy earthquake nerds aren't, they don't have their act all together either. So it's not like, we like to say we're all in this together. We realize, you know, we talk about outsmart disaster, right? Well, you don't have to be a genius to outsmart disaster. What we're saying, everybody can play a part in this. And, you know, it doesn't have to be a big deal. It can be a small thing, like just getting a pair of shoes tied to the bed, another pair of shoes in the trunk of the car. The reason I say that is because some people might wear shoes that are less comfortable for walking when they're going back and forth to work, but it'd be really handy to have a comfortable pair just stashing in the trunk of the car. Also some extra water in the trunk of the car, if I forgot to mention before, but think about that. You know, you might have a pair of comfy shoes, but you might not have enough water to be able to make it those extra miles to get to a safe place if you do get stranded. So, you know, it's just something that, as we who work on earthquakes for a job, think about this kind of thing all the time. Maybe most people don't think about earthquakes all the time. We shouldn't be complacent and say, oh, well, you know, I see those buildings collapse there, but that's the other side of the world, and maybe they don't have the same stringent building codes. But that's something else to be aware about here, too, because not all of our buildings in California are earthquake safe. Some are older and grandfathered in from previous codes. And so there is work to do, definitely, here in California.
It all comes down to the old Boy Scout motto, be prepared. Thanks to our guests, Tom Broker from the United States Geological Survey in Menlo Park and Ken Hudnut from the USGS in Pasadena. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in Northern California. You can listen to this and past episodes at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to Blue Dot on NPR Podcasts so you never miss a program. We're distributed nationally by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz, and our new engineer and producer is a man whose very name inspires you to keep looking up, Mr. Sky Schofield. I'm Dave Schlom, and for all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.